From the European Broadcasting Union in Geneva, this is the Eurovision News Podcast.
In this episode, we delve into the art and impact of storytelling in journalism. To do this, we're joined by Liam O'Brien, an award-winning documentary maker and chair of the EBU's Audio Storytelling Group. We explore the nuances of telling captivating stories, the responsibility of journalists as storytellers, and how strategic narrative can significantly enhance the connection and impact on an audience. I hope you find this episode as insightful and compelling as I did. Please welcome Liam O'Brien.
Lovely to be here, Laurent. Looking forward to it.
Your recent documentary, Black Rock Boys, received a prestigious award for Best European Audio Documentary Investigation of the Year at the 2023 Prix Europa. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about it and the inspiration behind it?
Yeah, so that story essentially was the story of two boys who, 40 years on from being abused in one of Ireland's most prestigious secondary schools or boarding schools for, you know, boys aged 12 to 18, they kind of broke the omerta on the abuse that was taking place in that institution and actually in a network of private boarding schools across Ireland. And I mean, no different than a lot of stories we've told in the past. Our job as public service broadcasters is to give voice to those who've had their voices taken from them a lot of the times, and then give them the care and attention and space to tell their stories. And that documentary, I mean, it was very powerful in and of itself. They were extremely brave. But I don't think any of us, including them, could have foreseen the repercussions, which is, you know, thousands of new victims stepped forward. It looks like it's resulted in the largest public inquiry in the history of the state that's going to be announced later this summer. And actually just last Monday week ago, the first criminal charges were brought before the courts in Ireland. And a man has been charged with 23 counts of indecent assault against seven boys dating back to that time in the late 1970s. And there's a further 12 individuals to go before the court. So, you know, their real life effects and changes out of a story being told.
I can imagine there's a great deal of personal satisfaction in bringing their voices to the public and seeing the repercussions.
Sure, there is after you've done that and after it's been well received. But during that process, it is, you know, you have the responsibility that you ordinarily have as a public broadcaster, and that you ethically you have to be sound in what you're saying. Morally, you've got to be on the money. Legally, you've got to be very clear and careful. And then you also take on this kind of invisible responsibility, I would call it, in that I was very well aware once Mark and David Ryan were the names of the men involved. Once Mark and David had shared their story with us and that we, RTÉ, as the public broadcaster here in Ireland, had broadcast it, we forever changed their identities. They were no longer Mark and David Ryan. They were Mark and David Ryan, who were abused at Black Rock, which was the name of the school, and who were the ones who first stepped up and broke that omerta. And forevermore, that changed their lives. So, you know, you can overthink these things. But in terms of, like, we're very, you have to be responsible storytellers in this place, and that we understand that for me, that is a piece of work. It is a story that I must shape and carve into being the most educational, engaging, at times entertaining, even though that's a very crass word in the type of story we're talking about, but you've got to bring audiences with you. So that's my job, that's my function. And yet for them, it's their lives, of course. So you're trying to marry those two things, which I guess is at the heart of public service, really, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, as journalists, we're usually focused on facts and figures. And with a project like this, there's an element of weaving a story to engage the listener. How do you balance those two?
Well, at all times, you must be factual. and at all times you must be accurate. But in terms of stories getting deep down inside somebody, like a viewer or a listener, it's oftentimes not the facts that will do that. It's the pieces of the story that are in between the facts. So it's the effect of what happened. For instance, the really legally contentious elements of a story like that are, who did the abuse? Where did it take place? Are there witnesses? Can you corroborate the, you know, all the things that you would look at when you're stacking up a prosecution, even in a court of law? We must be able to back up that and have secondary sources. But for a listener or a viewer, that's not how they are going to engage with the story. So they hear it. They trust in us as the public broadcaster to kind of have done all that work. And it's the emotion in between. It's the effects of the story. So in this instance, the effects were profound because they were over a 40-year period. And literally the story just tracked the effect in these men's lives over 40 years. So you had the moments of abuse back in the late 70s and early 80s. And then it's what it did to their lives as they progressed through life. And that's where you actually get the impact. But you can, I mean, that's part and parcel of what I'd call long form storytelling. So it's hard to get kind of, you know, if you think of the corkscrew effect, you literally have to drive yourself down into the heart and soul of the story, of your protagonists, of your characters. And that must happen for your listener and your viewer. They must go with you on that journey. So you need time to do that. You need space to do that. And a lot of that time and space takes place in between the facts.
Hmm. And for journalists who are not publishing for longer form outlets, are there elements of storytelling that are can help them in capturing their audience?
Absolutely. I mean, everything we do is a story. So, you know, whomever will be listening to this podcast, if they're to go away from this podcast, having listened to it, and to tell somebody else about what they've heard today, what they're actually doing is telling a story. And they'll each have a different story to tell. So they might remember different bits, they might misremember different bits, whatever way it works. So in all forms of communication in life, it's actually a story that we tell. Now, oftentimes, that sense of story can get lost in reportage, in news, because there is a clearly understandable focus on the facts. But even when you're must be factually accurate, which is in news and all public broadcasting, that doesn't mean that you can't control the flow of those facts. And the flow of information is all about story. So, like a really simple example that I sometimes give at training is, if you're reporting on a football match, the story of the football match as it happened is your story began with the whistle to begin the match, and your story ended when the whistle blew up the match, the finish, and the climax was the result. Now, oftentimes when that information is being reported, what will happen is, a lot of broadcasters around Europe, they will report the climax of the story at the beginning. So they will say, today's match, Liverpool and Manchester United drew 1-1. So straight away, that's the climax of your story in the wrong place. The climax of your story should always be at the end. So what you do is you can open up, you can remain factually accurate and say, for instance, today's match between Liverpool and Manchester United was a very tight affair. And then you can begin to tell the story of what happened in the first half, in the second half, climax, the result. So it's you're not changing, you're not mishandling, you're not misinforming any of the information. You always remain factually accurate, but there is a skill in ordering the information into a story. And almost always the tension in story comes naturally within its timeline. So in that match, it's naturally there. But what happens is when we tell that information, we then change, we can alter, in some cases destroy the inherent tension and manipulate it, because we are the holders of the information now when we're giving it to somebody else. So yeah, at all times, everything should be approached in a story first certainly in terms of how you think about it, because ultimately you will engage more people for longer and, you know, in deeper ways.
What I'm hearing from you is that instead of using a natural story arc to tell the story in a lot of news, we're using the climax as the hook. As a journalist, you spelled it out for us with an example, but maybe you could walk us through other ways to hook the audience with a story.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess what a lot of news, so there's a pressure in news in that you have to deliver big moments and big stories oftentimes, and obviously stories that are at times really challenging to engage with for viewers and listeners, and that at times can be off-putting. For instance, if you're reporting on a bombing from Ukraine, Gaza, Russia, Israel, wherever the situation is, I mean, it can at times you almost push away. But I think there's always room to try. And I guess when you tell stories well, what you're trying to do is maximize their impact. That's ultimately what we do. And that, ultimately that results in either larger audiences or bigger audiences, or audiences understanding the stories better, or staying with the stories for longer, even if they're short form. So, I mean, I understand that there's a pressure from, in the world we live in, that headlines lead, and then the body of a story comes after. I think there's room to more carefully manage the headline, in which the story should actually lead rather than the headline. So, I think that as public broadcasters particularly, I think there's an onus on us to change that. There's a responsibility on us that not everything can be explained in 10 to 20 seconds. And you've got to feel and witness and hear and view things to get a wider and better understanding.
You're also the EBU Audio Storytelling Group chair. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that group?
Yeah, so it's a great group. It's we're celebrating 50 years in existence, actually, this year, later on in May in Rome, being hosted by Rai, the Italian public broadcaster. So the group itself started off in 1974, and it was called the International Features Conference. And feature, I guess, is a word that has kind of, we've outgrown essentially in the community, but feature was a piece of radio work that would traditionally be seen as documentary. So it's a story essentially, or a topic, but it's done in a kind of a way where you weave story, you weave sound, you weave scene, all of that kind of stuff through audio. So over the last 50 years, practitioners from public broadcasters predominantly, although freelancers have had an involvement too, we gather together once a year, and it's our training event. So it's non-competitive, which is really good and really healthy. And it's a place where we share and care, share a lot of mistakes, share a lot of things that worked, things that didn't work. And I think as a body, as an EBU collective, that's the power in it, in that it's a place where you can trust. So you can go there openly and say, well, look, we had this really big project. We did this, we did that. Actually, it didn't engage audiences. And now we know why, and here's why. And that will help other broadcasters not make that mistake. So equally, we can, it's a place to showcase where things worked really well. And this year, for the first time, well, over the last number of months, we've changed the title to Storytelling, because feature no longer means anything to many people. But also because fiction is becoming, it's not that it's becoming part of the factual world, but I think it would be fair to say that audiences, certainly in storytelling, care less about what's true and what's not, and more about being entertained. So you won't hear somebody saying, I saw a brilliant factual series on Netflix, or I saw a brilliant fictional series on Netflix. They just say, I'm watching this great thing on Netflix. And so that's very challenging in some ways for public broadcasters, when you get this idea, especially when you worked in fact, like we do, and then you're challenged by bringing in elements of fiction, and does that damage and corrode trust with audiences and so many things. But nevertheless, we've got to challenge ourselves, and we have lots to learn from the storytelling skills in drama. And in the same way that, news might have things to learn from how factual units are storytelling, we in turn have things to learn from how drama tells a story. So it's all story. And so we're trying to incorporate elements, we are incorporating elements of fiction this year. And we're looking forward to see where that takes us.
What is it about audio for you personally, as a medium that you focused on, that you're attracted to?
It's the rawness and the proximity. So very, very, very rarely will I have somebody saying no to an interview. And I'm aware that my colleagues, I have done some television as well. It's a lot more of a challenge to get inside and deeper into stories when there's a camera there. And it's also the depth at which you can get into a story. I find that the fact that it's just, generally speaking, me and a microphone or whomever from our team is going out, it's a one-on-one relationship. So you don't generally get that in television because, if you're going out for a big shoot, for a big get of a guest, you'll have a full rig, a crew, or whatever. So it's a totally different situation. So, in some instances where I'm interviewing people, the only thing I'm concerned with is, one, what they're saying, and two, the way in which I'm fitting into that scene for them. So if it's a child, they'll be sitting on the floor. If it's, whatever it is, you can't think like that when you have a camera there, and it's a different format, and it's a different way of telling stories. So I just find, that story feels a lot less corrupted in audio. It feels a lot more natural. And I feel, over the years, it's not so much that I feel, but we've, experienced that we've been able to tell bigger stories, I guess, than visual has.
And when you're working on something like your last project, Black Rock Boys, this is a very deep and hard story, and a lot of discomfort on the subject's part. How do you put them at ease? How do you gain their trust?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that we all need to do is, when you meet somebody, you have a very short amount of time to gain the trust, in which to get, in some instances, people's deepest, darkest moments. Or in news, it can be at the, you meet somebody after an explosion, for instance, and they're at their most vulnerable. So you have you want to get the information to tell other people, but equally you have a responsibility to the person to, not to protect them necessarily, but sometimes, there'll be a rabbit in the headlights, as we might say here. They're not quite sure. So I've no doubt, like, for instance, in the case of Black Rock Boys, the two men I spoke to, it was actually the first time that either of them had spoken to anyone outside of a clinical setting.
Wow.
And spoke of their abuse. So that in itself was a huge moment for them. In one of the men, David, who was, it's not that there's a scale of better or worse abuse when it comes to abuse, but the abuse he suffered was definitely, it was far more damaging on his life. But in David's case, I actually did, as I mentioned there with a child, I actually sat on the floor. So I would, and even when I walk into a room for something like that, I will never tell an interviewee where to sit. Especially if there's stories that are delicate like that, I'll say, you tell me where you're comfortable. That will be from our first moment of engagement. So it'll be the location. I'll encourage people to be in their safe zone, which is their house, generally speaking. So I will try and empower them as best I can on every single level, you know. And in what I do, we always say tape is cheap. So I have no issue sitting there for 3 hours listening to someone, because that's part of the role, that's part of the job. In news, I appreciate it's different. You've got to turn it around. It's, you know, you've different pressures. But our job is primarily to listen, actually, rather than to ask questions. So the strongest interviewees will generally be the ones that you have to ask the least of. And, you know, I simple things, I will never interrupt a guest, ever. Like a golden rule for me, I always say it to people who are involved in training with, when someone has finished speaking, count to five in your head. And only then ask your next question. And oftentimes, that might even result in an awkward silence. But it puts the kind of onus back in the interviewee to fill it. And oftentimes, that's when they come out with things that, it's not that you're trying to trick them, but it's things that they might have been holding back and they just go with it. And everything is about an incremental engagement and relationship of trust. So if you have a difficult question, which you most likely will in a lot of scenarios, the question you kind of don't want to ask, and you'll know what that question is by the sense of uncomfortableness it gives you as an interviewer, you leave that one to last, obviously enough. You know, there's simple enough ways in which you can engage with people. Oftentimes I'll ask an interviewee, especially if it's something like that, is where would they like to begin? So you empower. And the more somebody feels in control, the more they control the situation, the more you will get out of them. The more they will tell you, the more comfortable they will feel.
Now, how, as a storyteller and as a documentary maker, you have an objective to tell a story. When you meet with a subject and you begin your interview, there's a certain element of you wanting to extract something. How do you balance that aspect of listening and being open to with your goals of telling a story?
It depends on the scenario, to be honest. I mean, sometimes you might be, by the time I get to somebody's door, they might be well aware of why I'm trying to interview them. Other times, the meeting might be on the basis that I'm coming and they want to find out why I want to do this. And then once they, you know, like, for instance, I'm working in a series at the moment, a co-production with Roof, the Icelandic public broadcaster. And that project began with, it's a story of a missing Icelandic man who went missing here in Dublin, in Ireland. 5 years on, he still hasn't been found. But that project began with the family interviewing us, the journal, the co-producer that I'm working with in Iceland, and myself. And the family asked us all these questions. Why are we doing this? What do we want to do with it? How are we going to do it? And then, once they were happy and they had time to think about it, then the charts flip and we start asking the questions, which is what normally happens. Mm. But yeah, it's not that it's a game of cat and mouse, but a lot of stories want to be told, and a lot of people are ready to talk and waiting to talk. And oftentimes, you know, interviewers can get in the way of that. So I find a lot of times it's just kind of be steady and be listening is the biggest skill in an interview, as distinct from the questions, you know. And oftentimes, certainly in a live situation, that's a very different nuance, because you've got to keep the interview moving. But you don't need to do that in a pre-recorded situation. You can take your time and leave them take their time.
News is currently dealing with a lot of news avoidance, and attracting audiences to stay engaged is a big challenge. How do you feel like storytelling fits into that dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, so much of what we do, certainly in terms of what I'm doing, podcast series and documentaries, almost every success of the success around what we do almost always comes down to story choice, virtually always. So, for instance, we're telling a story at the moment about, it's called Runaway Joe. It's a 9-part series. We're on, we just finished off episode 8 this morning. And it's about us hunting for an Irish-American man who's on the run from the FBI for the last 60 years. It's their longest running case. So the story choice in that is what appeals. It's the chase. And actually, underneath the belly of that, then we're able to tell a story of coercive control, of violence towards women, of all these other aspects of story. But you don't necessarily have the luxury of story choice in news, because your job isn't to choose necessarily, it's to report. So, you know, it's a difficult dilemma to be in. And, you know, whilst I'm talking about the craft of story a lot and, you know, where you start and where you begin, the reality is, you know, in any newsroom around Europe, you're reacting to what's happening in your country on a day-to-day basis. But I think that is the reactionary kind of news. I think behind that, there are certainly opportunities to be able to tell the news in a different way. We're starting to see, for instance, in podcasts, you can see slow news is becoming a much bigger trend because people want to go behind the headlines. And there certainly is a perfect marriage of factual storytelling that I'm involved in and news, you know. So not everything is about in the moment. And I think audiences are changing also. And they don't necessarily, it's not necessarily the headlines they're interested in anymore. It's a deeper dive and stuff. You know, you see long reads now becoming a lot more popular online and lots of different ways. So I think ultimately story wins out, you know.
Working in a really busy newsroom myself, I see things flying past our desk on a daily basis, and there just isn't enough time to add reference, and storytelling adds that reference. And I think it's incredibly valuable.
Yeah. I mean, oftentimes it's interesting. Often the news is basically where we find all our stories. And more often than not, they're in the stories that have been overlooked.
Mm.
And that's where you get real depth. And that's where you get your biggest performing series almost always. And this is the stories that others have overlooked.
I'm curious about that actually. If you're using the news to locate your slower stories or your documentaries, you just touched on that briefly, but I'm curious, there's probably a lot of depth there. How do you identify that there's something more there?
Well, for instance, if I look at the one that I mentioned about Iceland, so that's the story of an Icelandic man who left Iceland to come to Dublin to play a poker tournament. And within 24 hours of arriving here for the very first time, he disappeared. So that's a news story at the time. Man goes missing in Dublin. And then it has these other elements that I see attractive in terms of story, which are a kind of a USP, you could sort of say. So one, he's Icelandic. Two, it's poker. So I'm wondering what's going on there. Then all his family come over and we see little, you know, appeals through the news over a period of months, and it kind of flitters away. And so that's a kind of story that I would bank. I'd put into like a book or an Excel sheet and say, I'll check back in on that in 6 or 12 months when others have forgotten about it, when the news cycle has moved on. So when I checked back, I realized actually that story has totally died. Nothing happened. 2 years in, 3 years in, nothing. And then as it transpires, when we contact the family, they haven't heard from the cops in 4 years. You know, they haven't heard from the Irish police, they haven't heard from the Icelandic police. We go interviewing everybody. And then 2 weeks ago, I'm up in Dublin behind the scenes with the Irish police and the search because they put a new investigative team on it. They've done a whole new search because of information we've unearthed in the podcast. So now suddenly we're doing this behind the scenes cooperation. My story now is at the inside of the investigation, but all that came from spotting it in the news, saying it's a little unusual, that story, and just seeing what happened it over time. And that happens more often than you'd think. Happens an awful lot, where you check a story and you just say, what happened that? And that's That's one, it's our job to do that. But two, we do have the time to do it. You don't have the time in a newsroom to go back 6-12 months down the line and say, I wonder what happened, Johnny, the guy we reported on 12 months ago, because there's a new Johnny, there's a new story, there's a new global, you know, so they're different kind of things. But like, that's not to say that if you had a good news editor and say, I want this newsroom to start identifying long form news stories. I want us to put up a board. And if there's a story that you just can't, that's kind of got stuck in your heart or stuck in your head, just put it up there and let's talk about it in 6 months. You know, there are opportunities if you make those opportunities. That's kind of what it comes down to a bit. But you need somebody with kind of big picture, not analysis, but just to, that's how you kind of shape a newsroom. You know, that's how you'll give it an overall, you'll change the kind of culture and say, yes, of course, the day-to-day, the hour-to-hour reportage and information that we've got to give people, we do that. That's our primary function. But there are other things we can start to do. It's like when we made a shift, as in Dock and One, our unit, made a shift from going digital first on the radio. It's at that time when we were transitioning, we had people who said, one, there's no way that stuff should be on the podcast, you cheapen your radio broadcasts. You had that. You had two, you had the disbelievers. Like, you have to try these things. And when you try and fail, that's where we learn the most as public broadcasters.
I'm wondering, as someone who's working with quite sensitive material, do you ever find some difficulty balancing that line between advocate and journalist?
Oh, sure. Yeah, because you feel your emotions get in the way if you get too close to a story. And that's why you need a good editor above you. Like, I'm experienced 20 odd years or whatever, and I'm in charge of a team. But when I'm telling stories myself, I need an editor above me. And you must have that. What's that? It's a kind of a protection around every program maker, because irrespective of experience, you can get lost in the forest, you know, and especially when it's deep, deep emotional stuff. Because, like, we'll say before that documentary went out, and I knew how we'd some sense of how big, and like, that documentary is going to cost, in, you know, the Irish state in excess of €1 billion in compensation. That's the perceived wisdom at the moment. It's going to change the Irish law, like lots of things yet to happen. So we knew this was a big story even before it happened. But like, a couple of days out, I had to sit down with the guys and one witness, another lady who was in the documentary, and I alone, because that was the relationship, had to sit down with them and listen to the documentary together to ensure that they, one, they weren't hearing it on air for the first time, and two, that they were happy is the wrong word, but that they, what I was saying was factually accurate from their perspective also. And like, whatever way you dress that up, that an experience like that stays with you, you know? Like, these were two brothers, and the first time they heard each other's story in depth was in that listening session.
Wow.
You know, so like, it changed their lives, and one of them has died since, you know? So like, yeah, of course, then the line between being a kind of a confidant, a shoulder to cry on, the journalist, the person who's got to have the response, like, all those lines get a bit mixed up, and you've got to have this protection around you. And that's what editorial structures are there for. And they really kick in, you know. And I don't think, I couldn't necessarily say this in public, but a commercial broadcaster could never have made that documentary, because they wouldn't have had all the care around the making of it. You know, that's where PSBs, you know, that's the line that ultimately differentiates us, like, I think.
Interesting. If someone wants to learn more about storytelling or the work that you do, where should they go?
So our website is rte.ie docandone, which is documentary and one. in terms of the, and there's an EBU website, obviously, for our webpage, rather, for the Audio Storytelling Festival. Yeah, and I mean, in general terms, it's like, you know, the premise of story hasn't changed much in hundreds of years. Like, you look at most Hollywood movies and they're premised on Aristotle's storytelling graph. You know, it's not brain surgery. It's not brain science. Even if you just kind of read up the basics of storytelling about, you know, the start, where to start, where to end, what goes on in the middle, even that alone, it'll just shape. Yeah, it'll shape how you see things a little clearer, I think. That's ultimately about, yeah, it's about how we communicate the message through, ultimately, the story.
Liam O'Brien, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise.
You're more than welcome, Laurent.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you would like to hear more, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, and telling a friend about us. This is Laurent Frat, producer of the podcast. The music was created by Mickey Curling, and Martin Lonisser took care of the sound. Thank you from all of us.